Blog Talk Radio.
Come on in. This sermon is going to be a series of sermons on Jewish communism and Bolshevism. They're the same thing, and the reason that this is of interest to Satanists is because Christianity is Jewish communism and Bolshevism. They are the same exact program. There isn't any difference between them other than one it comes in as a political face and the other one comes trying to say they're a religion. And they're both the same identical thing. They have the same identical procedures of what they do. Christianity is a stepping off point, a preparation to receive the slave labor of Bolshevism. And I'm going to tell you something straight up. I have studied and I have researched in depth for many, many years now under the guidance of Satan. And if Christians argue and stuff, they're God, so-called, what they call God and the devil are backwards. And that's why some of this backwards deals that the Christians twist and pervert and distort, so Satanism, everything backwards, like in lyrics and all that stuff, it's just senseless nonsense. But the truth is, what they call God and what they call the devil are backwards. Jehovah, the one called Jehovah of the Old Testament, is the real devil. Okay, and I don't mean to say devil actually comes from a word Davy from the Far East. And I go into exposingchristianity.com. You can type it in. It explains everything in detail. The Bible with the numbers in it, it's a book of Jewish witchcraft that they used to enslave the world. All of these Jewish programs. And we have already exposed Christianity, and we are now working to expose its twin, Bolshevism and communism. And it is not just Russia and the so-called Iron Curtain. It's got the same procedures that they have, mass murder, torture, and slavery. They push everyone to slavery, and this is in the Talmud. And the Jews will lie, and they will say the protocols of the learned elders of Zion and the Talmud, and that, you know, the quotes from the Talmud are false. This is not true. They are prolific liars. Just like Christianity, they say it's these programs suck people in through ignorance. And ignorance is not stupidity necessarily, it's just not knowing. It's through lack of knowledge. And they get people to come in, like they say Christianity, oh, we've done so much for the poor and all this. Well, one modus operandi of the Jews is the Jews invent the problem. They create the problem and they promote the problem, and then they come in with the solution. And Christianity, for, I don't know, ever since its inception, has indoctrinated people subliminally and also, I mean, blatantly in the Bible that owning material possessions and having things, that, you know, wealth or whatever, is a sin. Or it's wrong. And it's a virtue to be poor. And people going into these churches, sitting there, nodding off under the boring preachers of the sermons, they know what they're doing. These preachers up there preaching the most boring crap that you could listen to and just wasting your time in there. There's nothing spiritual about it. And while these people are nodding off in there because they're tired, and a lot of them, you know, compulsory church, a lot of us have been subjected to this garbage, sit there, and they're taking it in, and while they're logical, conscious mind is not fully awake, the subconscious is just taking it in, and that's why a lot of people have money problems. And then Christianity creates the poverty problem, and then they come in and they supposedly, you know, have a solution to it, which isn't true. Only 10% of donations to Christian charities go to the victims, and this is a truth. Years ago, when I was at the university, there was a college professor I'll never forget, and he was really interesting. And he remarked, he had like a sabbatical or, you know, where he went to study in Russia. And this was back in the 1980s, around early 80s, where it was still the USSR. They were under communist control. And he went over there, and he could not... He was, like, astounded at how friendly the Russian people were and how hospitable they were. I mean, one woman, he was touched. He said that she shared her vodka with him. And he couldn't understand how they wanted to live under Bolshevism. And a lot of people don't know anything about Bolshevism. It is a Jewish program, and it is a twin of Christianity. There are no differences. And when the Jews cannot get you with Christianity, then they push Bolshevism. It's back and forth. Like, the Bolshevism fails. Another I know I'm skipping around here a little bit. I'm not the best speaker, but I'm going to be reading some things here to enlighten people. And this is very, very serious because they're trying to establish this garbage in America. And every time they do, you can bet your sweet ass you're going to be dead, your family's going to be dead, and most people you know are going to be dead. Under the most heinous conditions imaginable, if these communist Bolsheviks take over America here, and America, the United States of America right now, is the last free, so-called free, okay, major power of the world. And they've been working at it for I don't know how long to try to bring it down under the communist yoke. They're the ones that want to take over the entire world, the Jews. And anybody that knows the Jews knows their greed. But I want to mention something. I used to work out in the gym all the time, and there was a woman, this one was a small gym, and there was a woman who was working out there, and we'd talk to each other sometimes, you know, in between sets and stuff, weightlifting. And she was a Mormon. And back at this time, this is the early 90s, okay, after the fall of the Iron Curtain and USSR came down under Gorbachev. Well, anyway, she told me, I was an atheist at the time, but she was told me that her parents were over now in the USSR as missionaries promoting the Christian doctrines, Mormonism, you know, the Christian plague over there. And it's like as soon as like communism falls or something or that fails, the Jews have another backup program right away. And there are no conflicts. By the way, Jesus Christ never existed. That is another Jewish invention. The reason they can't find anything on him is because he was never there. And a lot of stuff they invent. And another thing I want to interject here, okay, there's a website, if you go to Satan's Library on the web, it's located, if you can, you can find it on the JOS website under the Black Sun, under links, Satan's Library. And we have a lot of PDFs on there. And things that explain the truth, you know, trying to enlighten people. I know a lot of people, are listeners, okay? They don't really care to sit down and read books. I've read probably 10,000 books in my life, cover to cover. You have to research certain things. But if you go to the Real Holocaust PDF on there or the Real Holocaust website that, you know, is linked, you will find that the Holocaust that they call the Jewish Holocaust, that never happened. It's mathematically impossible, for one, the methods, and this has been proven on the internet, and they try to take it down all the time. It's gained them all kinds of, that's how they got their state of Israel and kicked the Palestinians out, just kicked them out, took their land, and relegated them to living in tents, which is, that's in the Jewish Talmud, that they own everything in the world, and the Gentiles are just dog slaves for them. And they have been using this Holocaust in a lot of ways, which is typical of a Jew. They're opportunists in the most abusive, heinous ways to cover for the real heinous horrors against humanity committed by the communists. You get into studying about communism and researching communism, you will find that the true concentration camps, famine, and the most slave labor is Jewish communism. And if the truth be known, okay, I'm not going to get into this. This is on the Real Holocaust website. They've been using that as a cover and a distraction. For the real slave labor, of course, they're always promoting Bolshevism. When I was in school, like in the fourth grade, I'll never forget, there was a teacher, and this is back in the early 70s, and she told the class, you know, innocently, I guess she was over at the university, you know, studying and that, and she told the class innocently, she said, communism, a lot of people are against it, but it's just the way people want to live. That isn't true. It is the way people are forced to live, and whether they like it or not. And there are so many stories, the Berlin Wall and everything, about how people have risked their lives, their very lives. They've given up all their material possessions with just a shirt on their back to get away from that plague. Every week when I was growing up, through when I was a teenager and that, I grew up in the 1970s. And back then, there was no such things as computers or iPads or internet. Not even DVD players or VHS players, okay? Back in those days, there was like four or five channels. It was like a radio, an old radio, and you know, your TV on, you pull a knob, there's no digital anything, and you get four or five channels, and you either watched what was on or you didn't watch anything. But during this time, there was just about every week, there was something about that Jewish phony Holocaust that was on every single week, indoctrinating the public. One was Holocaust. It was, I think, a six-part series or something about, you know, these Jewish victims, those big bad Nazis, Auschwitz. You know, how many people know about Auschwitz? Practically the world, okay? But how many people know about Siberian slave labor under the Jews, what Gentiles went through? And most of them did not live to tell, and there's not prolific pictures of it. And I'm also finding in my research on Russian slave labor, okay, there's Cambodia, they took over different countries in that, and I mean, each one, I'm going to go into it. China, Red China is another one. It'd make your hair stand, and then what they did to people. Most of them never lived to tell. But a lot of these photos of these skeletons piled up are from Russian Siberian slave labor camps, and the Jews take pictures, and they twist it, and they say it's their own. But it's not true. I'm running across certain photos that I remember. I've done a lot of research in my life, and the sad thing is a person has to do tons of research to get to the truth. What Jewish communism is it is a slave labor state. Upper party bosses, you know, that belong to the Communist Party, most of whom are Jewish, and if they're not Jewish, they're married to Jews, they get special privileges, and that sort of thing, live a lot better than the average Gentile over there. And the average Gentile just lives horribly. Even these days, under Stalin, there were millions murdered. And I'm talking there were false arrests, and in order to get a quota of slave labor, they would go around to people and just accuse them of just about anything, Russian citizens, the average Russian citizen, haul them off to the prison where they were tortured into giving a confession. I'm going to read some excerpts from some books, and this is very, very serious, and I strongly encourage everyone who listens to this and is able to get the word out in some way, because we're all in danger here, and I know a lot of people can't see it. They're programmed by the television set and the YouTube. The Jews run 96% of Hollywood. Things like this are very rarely seen in movies. They keep it down. But that Holocaust, like I said, it's aired on television just every week. This book is called The Gulag Archipelago, 1918 to 1956, by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And he survived the Gulag, and he lived to write about it and get the word out. And he risked his life, I don't know how many times, trying to get the word out about what was really going on in the Soviet Union. And sadly, he was duped into turning to Christianity, like so many people. The Jew plays both sides. They pretend enemies, both opposing sides, and it claimed to be enemies of each other, and it's actually the Jews controlling the same program. And I don't know how many times Christianity is always whining about how communism is of the devil, and all, you know, meaning Satan, when they say it, and all this garbage. And they say, oh, well, you know, they're not allowed to worship, and that's a lie. That's not true. Their churches are still open over there. But, yeah, there's been priests that are arrested and stuff. They make a big deal out of it. You know, like the average Gentile person doesn't even matter what happens to them. Or if it's a Jew that's arrested, and yeah, there were. It's like you never hear the end of it. But they're playing both sides and towards the same thing. And he turned towards Christianity in the end, which is really sad, because it's like they're fighting they go from one to the other, and it's like you're disarmed, because it's like they're both Jewish programs, and unless you get them together and destroy them together is what Satan wants. That's what he wants me to do this sermon here and educate our people. Unless you destroy Christianity and communism, you know, the Jewish Bolshevism together, it's like you're going to keep fighting this. It's never going to stop until it kills you. It says here in his book, Arrest. Need it be said that that is the breaking point in your life, a bolt of lightning which has scored a direct hit on you? That is an unassimilable spiritual earthquake not every person can cope with, as a result of which people often slip into insanity. The universe has many different centers as there are living beings in it. Each of us is a center of the universe, and that universe is shattered when they hiss at you. You are under arrest. If you are arrested, can anything else remain unshattered by this cataclysm? But the darkened mind is incapable of embracing these displacements in our universe, and both the most sophisticated and various simpleton among us, drawing on all life's experiences, can only gasp out, "Me? What for?" And this is a question which, through repeated millions and millions of times before, has yet to receive an answer. Arrest is an instantaneous shattering thrust, expulsion, somersault from one state into another. And everything that is now compromised by the traditional, even literary, image of an arrest will pile up and take shape, not in your own disordered memory, but in what your family and your neighbors in your apartment remember. The sharp nighttime ring or rude knock at the door, the insolent entrance of the unwiped jackboots of the unsleeping state security operatives, the NKVD. Okay, that was the predecessor of the Jewish KGB. And they used these same tactics in the Christian Inquisition. You were guilty no matter what, and they even prosecuted your descendants. It's like you had no rights whatsoever. The frightened and cowed civilian witness at their backs. And what function does this civilian witness serve? The victim doesn't even dare think about it, and the operatives don't remember, but that's what the regulations call for, and so he has to sit there all night long and sign in the morning. For the witness, jerked from his bed, it is torture to go out night after night to help arrest his own neighbors and acquaintances. This traditional image of arrest is also trembling hands packing for the victim. A change of underwear, a piece of soap, something to eat, and no one knows what is needed, what is permitted, what clothes are best to wear, and the security agents keep interrupting and hurrying you. You don't need anything. They'll feed you there. It's warm there. It's all lies. They keep hurrying you to frighten you. The traditional image of arrest is also what happens afterward when the poor victim has been taken away. It is an alien, brutal, and crushing force totally dominating the apartment for hours on end. A breaking, ripping open, pulling from the walls, emptying things out from wardrobes and desks onto the floor, shaking, dumping out, and ripping apart, piling up mountains of litter on the floor, and the crunch of things being trampled beneath jackboots. And nothing is sacred in a search. During the arrest of a locomotive engineer, Enoshin, a tiny coffin stood in his room containing the body of his newly dead child. The jurists, in quotation marks, unquote, dumped the child's body out of the coffin and searched it. They shake sick people out of their sick beds and they unwind bandages to search beneath them. For those left behind after the arrest, there is a long tail end of a wrecked and devastated life, and the attempts to go and deliver food parcels. But from all the windows, the answer comes in barking voices. Nobody here by that name. Never heard of them. Yes, and in the worst days in Leningrad, it took 5 days of standing in crowded lines just to get to that window. And it may be only half a year that the arrested person responds at all. Or else the answer is tossed out, deprived of the right to correspond. And that means once and for all, no right to correspondence. And that almost for certain means has been shot. Now, getting back, I'm interrupting here from the book. I'm reading excerpts. These people were taken to the main Soviet prison in Moscow. Most of them, that were Muscovites, to the Lubyanka. That was where they were held. And there was no heat in any of the cells, and we're talking Russian winters here. We're not talking like, you know, Midwestern United States or moderate climate of Europe. I'm talking the most brutal cold you can imagine. I know, because I'm from the northern United States, and I know how cold it can get. And these people weren't even given any heat in their cells, and they were just like with the Inquisition. And the Pravda newspaper, which is the main communist newspaper, it's very common in the Soviet Union, stated, I have a quote, and if you look up the real Holocaust, com, and it's also on Exposing Christianity. I put on several articles there that Christianity is the mother of Bolshevism, and the same exact torture tactics, only a little bit more variation here, same procedure happened in the Christian Inquisition. Now, getting back to reading this, what they did when they took the prisoner there is they forced them into a confession of something. I mean, just ludicrous crap that they didn't. Just an innocent person that they picked up, busted down the door of their home, whatever, made them sign a confession, beat them and tortured them, starved them, froze them. Put them in the most bug-infested boxes. I mean, just extreme torture until the person broke down and confessed or died. A lot of them died. It says, let us try to list some of the simplest methods which break the will and the character of the prisoner without leaving marks on his body. Let us begin with the psychological methods. These methods have been enormous and even annihilating impact on rabbits. I know he's being slang, but in meaning innocents. Who have never been prepared for prison suffering. And it isn't even easy for a person who holds the strongest convictions. One, first of all, night. Why is it all the main work of breaking down human souls went on at night? Why from the very earliest years did the organs select the night? The organs is, he's using another word here, it means the system, the Soviet system, the organs. Because at night the prisoner is torn from sleep, and even though he has not yet been tortured by sleeplessness, lacks his normal daytime equanimity and common sense. He is most vulnerable. 2. Persuasion. In a sincere tone and the very simplest method, why play at cat and mouse, so to speak? After all, having spent some time among others undergoing interrogation, the prisoner has come to see what the situation is. And so the interrogator says to him in a lazily friendly way, look, you're going to get a prison term, whatever happens. If you resist, you'll croak, meaning die, right here in prison, and you'll lose your health. But if you go on to camp, you'll have fresh air and sunlight. So why not sign now? Very logical. And for those who agree and sign and are smart, if the matter concerns only themselves. But that's rarely so. A struggle is inevitable. And I also want to interject something here. Else, most of these interrogators, and it's the same with the Inquisition, are Jewish. Another variant of persuasion is particularly appropriate to the party member. If there are shortages and even famine in the country, then you as a Bolshevik have to make up your mind. Can you admit that the whole party is to blame? Or the whole Soviet government? No, of course not. The director of the Flax Depot hastened to reply. Then be brave and shoulder the blame yourself, and he did. And another thing I want to interject is this communist Jewish psychology where they blame the victim for everything. It's like you're having problems that you never even had anything to do with, like, surviving. And the Jew makes it impossible to survive. It's like the more control they have, you're going to be dead. They get you so indebted, and you can't pay. The jobs are low pay, the whole five yards. And then no matter what you owe, these are choices you make. I don't know how many times I've heard this garbage before. And it's designed to instill depression and suicide in the victim. You're responsible for that. Well, you know, maybe there's a limited number of choices the average person is able to make, a limited number, but you cannot control the results. But the Jew tries to tell you that you can, and this is very, very common in Jewish psychiatry. And these stupid idiots that blame the victim for the problems that the victim has. In other words, the victim's to blame, the Jew is not, the system isn't to blame, you know, what you've been subjected to in life isn't to blame. Life certainly isn't to blame. The whole blame is on you. And that's what they do. And they break people down that way. And they also, it also causes self-hatred, self-blame, self-loathing, low self-esteem. It's no different from the Christian concept that you're born in original sin, so you're damned. And the only way out is through being saved. And that's a joke. That's a total lie. And I've gone into a lot of detail that I'm not going to spend this audio sermon on that. You just check exposingchristianity.com for that one. But here's another one. 4, psychological contrast was sometimes effective. Sudden reversals of tone, for example, are full. Okay, it goes on and it says, fool you, rat, I'll put 9 grains of lead in your skull. And he would advance on the accused, clutching his hands outstretched as if to grab by the hair, fingernails like needles. This worked very, very well with women prisoners. And they would get them, they would get family members to sign confessions against, like, their brother, their sister, their mother, their father, other relatives. And this is no different from the Judeo-Christian Bible when that Nazarene, which is a fictitious entity, that Jesus the Christ, for those of you, I call it the Nazarene because you spit on the damn thing, says, I will turn family members against family members, brother against brother, sister against sister, father against son, daughter against mother, etc. Members of his own household will be enemies against him. And that's it's in the New Testament. And this is no different what they do in the communism. I'm going to be wrapping this up here, and I'm going to start on another sermon here because this is getting to be too long. It's already 25 minutes. I'm ending this right now because it's 25 minutes long. You can go to sermon 2, and I'll take up from there. I don't want to have these sermons too long. Hail Satan. All right, I'm picking up here where I left off. This is sermon 2, okay? And if you're just listening to this, I strongly suggest you go to my first sermon on Jewish communism and Bolshevism, which is the identical twin of Christianity. They're both one and the same program. I don't want to make these sermons too long because it gets to be tedious, and that and it's also difficult to upload. But here, I'm picking up on during the Stalin era, and Joseph Stalin was a Jew, part Jew, and his real name was Joseph Dugashvili, which in Georgian means son of a Jew. And I could go on. I'll be naming all the Jewish heads of state over there in the communist regime. Most of them, they're either Jewish or they're married to Jews, like Leonid Brezhnev. He was married to a Jewess. He was a tater. But I'm going to go on here. They would come, the Soviet, the NKVD, which is the predecessor of the KGB, would come around, I mean, unexpected, to and start banging down, knocking down the doors of innocent Russian citizens under the Soviet regime and arresting them. And the purpose for this was for slave labor. The Jew wants disposable human beings. And this is going on in China, red communist China right now. And make no joke, don't be fooled by this. Jews come in all races. There's Chinese Jews, and if you look beneath the surface and do enough research, most of the Communist Party over there at the highest levels are Chinese Jews. Shanghai, it was a major city for, had a very large Chinese Jewish population, and there's an old expression, I don't know if a lot of people are old enough to remember this, but being Shanghai'd, that means being duped or swindled. Okay, the Jew comes in all races, and in the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, they make a statement that because they come in all different races, that's their power. They're a sub-race, and the Jews are a race. It is in their DNA. I'm not going to keep repeating this here, but read, go to Satan's Library or exposingchristianity.com, and it'll take you there. Satan's Library is located in the Black Sun link on the joyofsatan.org website under links. So you'd want to go to the Black Sun. There's a link right there, and you click on it. 666 Black Sun, and the Jews took this down, but we still have it on PDF, and you can check it out for yourself. I mean, somebody doesn't say, well, I'm a quarter Catholic, or I'm half Lutheran, or we have some Presbyterian blood in the family. Okay, the Jews are a race. You can draw a picture of a Jew, but you can't draw a picture of a Catholic or a Protestant, or even a Muslim for that matter. Now, I was getting back to hear how they tortured prisoners under the Soviet regime, and it was no different from how they tortured innocent people with the Christian Inquisition. Same tactics. It says, now this is from the book The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And he survived the gulag. He's a Russian citizen. He survived the gulag. But you have to go back to my first sermon. I'm not going to keep repeating this because I don't want to take too long on here. Prison begins with the box. In other words, what amounts to a closet or packing space. The human being who has just been taken from freedom, still in a state of inner turmoil, ready to explain, to argue, to struggle, is, when he first sets foot in prison, clapped into a box, which sometimes has a lamp and a place where he can sit down, but which sometimes is dark and unconstructed in such a way that he can only stand up, and even then he is squeezed against the door, and he is held there for several hours, or for half a day or a day. During those hours, he knows absolutely nothing. Will he perhaps be confined there all his life? He has never in his life encountered anything like this, and he cannot guess at the outcome. Those first hours are passing, when everything inside him is still ablaze from the instilled storm in his heart. Some become despondent, and that's the time to subject them to their first interrogation. Others become angry, and that too is all to the good, for they may insult the interrogator right at the start or make a slip, and it will be all the easier to cook up their case. Now this particular tactic, I'm interrupting here, really smacks of the Inquisition. When boxes were in short supply, they used to have another method. In the NKVD, Elena Strutsinskaya was forced to remain seated on a stool in the corridor for 6 days in such a way that she did not lean against anything, did not sleep, did not fall off, and did not get up from it. 6 days, just tried to sit that way for 6 hours. Then again, as a variation, the prisoner can be forced to sit on a tall chair of the kind used in laboratories so his feet do not touch the floor. They become numb in this position, and he is left sitting that way from 8 to 10 hours. Or else, during the interrogation itself, when the prisoner is out in plain view, he can be forced to sit in this way, as far forward as possible from the edge, move forward still, further still, of the chair so that he is under painful pressure during the entire interrogation. He is not allowed to stir for several hours. Is that all? Yes, that's all. Just try it yourself. Depending on the local conditions, a divisional pit can be substituted for the box. The prisoner was forced into such a pit, 10 feet in depth, 6.5 feet in diameter, and beneath the open sky, rain or shine, this pit was for several days both his cell and his latrine. And 10.5 ounces of bread and water were lowered to him on a cord. Imagine yourself in this situation just after you've been arrested, when you're all in a boil. Either identical orders to all special branches of the Red Army, or else similarities of their situations in the field, led to broad use of this method. This is another one that is very, very similar to the Inquisition. It was used during the Inquisition. The accused could be compelled to stand on his knees, not in some figurative sense, but literally on his knees without sitting back on his heels and with his back upright. People could be compelled to kneel in the interrogator's office or in the corridor for 12 or even 24 or 48 hours. The interrogator himself could go home, sleep, amuse himself in one way or another, and this was an organized system. Watch has kept over on the kneeling prisoner, and the guards work in shifts. What kind of prisoner was the most vulnerable to such treatment? One already broken, already inclined to surrender. During all these tortures, which involve standing for 3, 4, and 5 days, they ordinarily deprived a person of water. The most natural thing of all is to combine the psychological and physical methods. It is also natural to combine all the preceding methods with sleeplessness, which they quite failed to appreciate in medieval times. They did not understand how narrow are the limits within a human being can preserve his personality intact. Sleeplessness, yes, combined with standing, thirst, bright light, terror, and the unknown. What other tortures are needed? Befogs the reason and undermines the will, and the human being ceases to be himself, to be his own I. As in Chekhov's, I want to sleep, but there is much easier, for there the girl could lie down and slip into lapses of consciousness, which even in just a minute would revive and refresh the brain. A person deprived of sleep acts half-consciously or altogether unconsciously, so that his testimony cannot be held against him. They used to say, you are not truthful in your testimony, and therefore you will not be allowed to sleep. Sometimes as a refinement, instead of making the prisoner stand up, they made him sit down on a soft sofa, which made him want to sleep all the more. The jailer on duty sat next to him on the same sofa and kicked him every time his eyes began to shut. Here is how one victim, who had just sat out days in a box infested with bed bugs, describes his feeling after this torture. Chill from great loss of blood. Irises of the eyes are dried out as if someone were holding a red-hot iron in front of them. Tongue swollen from thirst and prickling from a hedgehog at the slightest movement. Throat racked by spasms from swallowing. Sleeplessness was a great form of torture. It left no visible marks and could not provide grounds for complaint, even if an inspection, something unheard of anyway, were to strike on the morrow. The bed bug infested box has already been mentioned. In the dark closet made of wooden planks, there were hundreds, maybe even thousands of bed bugs, which had been allowed to multiply. The guards removed the prisoner's jacket or field shirt, and immediately the hungry bed bugs assaulted him, crawling onto him from the walls or falling off the ceiling. At first he waged war with them strenuously, crushing them on his body and on the walls, suffocated by their stink, but after several hours he weakened and let them drink his blood without a murmur. This is another excerpt here, and it just gives you an idea. Millions upon millions of people were arrested under false allegations, and they were either shot right away, executed, tortured to death, or sent to Siberian labor camp where most of them never came back. It was impossible to survive alive. There's just small handfuls of people that survived. And like the Catholic Church, which is the same thing, they are working for communism, but they pretend publicly to be against it and fighting it. But under the table, they're working for it. The Jesuits, they want to establish serfdom. Now, this is during the Middle Ages where the Catholic Church ruled. And Stalin, that five-year plan garbage, and Chairman Mao had his own, I'm going to go into that, same thing, same identical procedures, mass arresting people for slave labor, disposable human beings, working them to death and just getting rid of them. They want people to be ignorant, and Stalin actually established a serfdom over there, like during the Middle Ages, where people were just worked to death. There's no real entertainment anywhere, nothing. They're just slave labor. And I'm also going to get into how the Russian people lived. Okay, I'm not going to make these sermons too long here, but they arrested everybody they could think of, especially intellectuals like students, college students, people who are learned, because you cannot have a slave state with intelligent, knowledgeable people. It just doesn't work. You have to keep slaves ignorant. And I also want to mention here, I have this, if you go to the Black Sun again, Satan's Library, that the Jews owned all of the slave ships and operated the African slave trade here to America, where they did the same very same thing, packed them like sardines. They did this in the Soviet Union too, in boxcars. Those are the real boxcars, where they went for weeks to Siberia, and a lot of them didn't make it there because of lack of food and water, no hygiene. I mean, it's horrific. Getting back to the Gulag Archipelago, it says, among those arrested were our own real spies abroad. These were often the most dedicated Comintern workers and Czechists, and among them were many attractive women. They were called back to the motherland and arrested at the border. They were then confronted with their former Comintern chief, for example, Mirov Korona, who confirmed that he himself had been working for one of the foreign intelligence services, which meant that his subordinates were automatically guilty too, and the more dedicated they were, the worse it was for them. And I also want to add that Russian prisoners of war, okay, that actually they didn't have it too bad. The German POW camps under the Nazi regime were very humane. And I know an American who he was in a German POW camp, and he was treated very well there. He was even allowed to get letters, and he spoke highly of the Germans. And I remember him telling us this a long time ago, and he made it home. When the Russians got home, back to Russia, USSR, after the Second World War, most of them were sent to Siberia because they were a threat to the communist state because they had seen more of the world. And, of course, they were caught, and that was a big no-no. I mean, they were supposed to die. But basically, they were sent to Siberia or executed because they saw more outside of what the communist system tried to indoctrinate them with and say that the rest of the world is hell and that Soviet Russia is paradise. And they keep indoctrinating people with these Jewish lies. Getting back to the book again, it says Soviet employees of the Chinese Eastern Railroad, the KVZHD, were one and all arrested as Japanese spies, including their wives, children, and grandmothers. But we have to admit these arrests had already begun several years earlier. Koreans from the Far East were sent into exile in Kazakhstan, the first experiment in mass arrests on the basis of race. Leningrad Estonians were all arrested on the strength of having Estonian family ties and charged with being anti-communist Estonian spies. All Latvian riflemen and all Latvian Czechists were arrested. Yes, indeed, those very Latvians who had been the midwives of the revolution, who just a short while before had constituted the nucleus and the pride of the Cheka. And with them, taken even those communists of bourgeois Latvia that had been exchanged in 1921 and had been freed thereby from the dreadful Latvian prison terms of 2 and 3 years, in Leningrad, the Latvian department of the Herzen Institute, the House of Latvian Culture, the Estonian Club, the Latvian Technicum, and the Latvian and Estonian newspapers were all closed down. In the midst of the general to-do, the big solitaire game was finally wound up, and those not yet taken were raked in. There was no longer any reason to keep it a secret. The time had come to write the finis in the whole game. So now, the socialists were taken off to prison, and whole exiles, for example, the Ulfa exile and the Saratov exile, and they were all sentenced together and driven off in herds to the slaughterhouses of the archipelago. Nowhere was it specifically prescribed that more members of the intelligentsia should be arrested than of other groups, but just as the intelligentsia had never been overlooked in previous ways, it was not neglected in this one. A student's denunciation, and this combination of words, student and denunciation, had ceased to sound as outlandish. That a certain lecturer in a higher educational institution kept citing Lenin and Marx frequently, but not Stalin, it was all that was needed for the lecturer not to show up for lectures anymore. And what if he cited no one? All Leningrad Orientalists of the middle and younger generation were arrested. The entire staff of the Institute of the North, except for its NKVD informers, was arrested. They went even after school teachers. In Sverdlovsk, one case involved 30 secondary school teachers and the head of the provincial education department, Perel. One of the terrible accusations against them was that they had made arrangements to have a New Year's tree in order to burn down the school. And the club fell with the regularity of a pendulum on the heads of the engineers, who by this time were no longer bourgeois but a Soviet generation of engineers. Because of an irregularity in the geological strata, two mine tunnels with mine surveyor Nikolai Merkurievich Mikov had calculated failed to do so. He got Article 57-7, 20 years. Six geologists, the Kotovich group, were sentenced to 10 years under Article 58-7 for intentionally concealing reserves of tin and ore in underground sites in anticipation of the arrival of the Germans. In other words, they failed to find the deposits. On the heels of the main waves followed an additional special wave of wives and the so-called CHS members of families. Among them were the wives of the important party leaders, and also in certain places, Leningrad, for example, the wives of all those who had been sentenced to 10 years without the right to correspond. In other words, those who were no longer among the living. The CHS, as a rule, all got eight years. Well, that was still less than the disposed kulaks got, and their children did not go to the archipelago. Piles of victims, hills of victims, a frontal assault of the NKVD on the city. In one way, for example, G.P. Matveyeva not only saw her husband, but all three of her brothers arrested, all in different places. Of the four, three never returned. An electrician had a high-tension line break in his sector, 58.7, 20 years. A perm worker, Novikov, was accused of planning to blow up a Kama River bridge. In the same city of Perm, Yuzhakov was arrested during the day, and at night they came for his wife. They presented her with a list of names and demanded that she sign a confession that they had all met in her house at the Menshevik SR meeting. Of course they had not. They promised in return to let her out to be with her children. She signed, destroying all those listed, and of course she herself remained in prison. Nadezhda Yudenovich was arrested because of her family name. True, they established after 9 months that she was not related to the white general, and they let her out. a mere trifle during the time her mother had died of worry. In 1930, a small boy, three brothers, Pavel, Ivan, and Stefan Boruszko, came to the Soviet Union from Poland to live with their parents. Now as young men, they were arrested for PSH, suspicion of espionage, and got 10 years. A streetcar motor woman of Krasnodar was returning on foot late at night from the car depot on the outskirts of the city. To her misfortune, she passed some people working to free a truck that had gotten stuck. It turned out to be full of corpses. Hands and legs stuck out from beneath the canvas. They wrote down her name, and the next day she was arrested. The interrogator asked her what she had seen. She told him truthfully, Darwinian selection, anti-Soviet agitation, 10 years. A plumber turned off the loudspeaker in his room every time the endless letters to Stalin were being read. His next-door neighbor denounced him. Where, oh, where is that neighbor today? He got SOE, socially dangerous element, 8 years. A half-literate stove maker used to enjoy writing his name in his free time. This raised his self-esteem. There was no blank paper around, so he wrote on newspapers. His friends found his newspaper in the sack in the communal toilet, with pen and ink flourishes across the countenance of the father and teacher. Anti-Soviet agitation. 10 years. Arrests rolled through the streets and apartment houses like an epidemic. Just as people transmit an epidemic infection from one another without knowing it, by such innocent means as a handshake, a breath, handing someone something, so too they passed on the infection of inevitable arrest by a handshake, by a breath, by a chance meeting on the street. For if you are destined to confess tomorrow that you organized an underground group to poison the city's water supply, and if today I shake hands with you on the street, that means I am too doomed. 7 years earlier, the city had watched while they massacred the countryside and considered it only natural. Now the countryside might have watched them massacre the city, but the countryside itself was dark for that and was still undergoing the finishing touches of its own slaughter. The surveyor, Saunin, got 15 years for cattle plague in the districts and for bad harvests. The entire leadership of the district was shot for the same reason. The secretary of a district party committee went into the fields to speed up the plowing, and an old peasant asked him whether he knew that for 7 years the collective farmers had received not one single ounce of grain in return for their labor days, and only straw, and very little of that. For his question, the peasant got ASA, anti-Soviet agitation, 10 years. I'm going to continue this in Sermon 3, and I strongly suggest you learn about this. I mean, I know a lot of people don't take the time to read. I will read to you, and I'm going to go into China, North Korea. Oh, it's just heinous. And it's all famine. Cannibalism has happened in all these countries. It's forced. I mean, it's just horrific. Nothing to eat, what they did to the Ukraine. And I'm going to go into the modern Russia, not Russia, but the USSR before they fell in the early 90s, 1991. I'm going to go into all of this and just give you an idea how these people lived and how they're looking for us to live. And this isn't some kind of a joke that you should take lightly or blow off or anything, because if you don't fight for freedom, if each one of us did not individually fight for freedom against this heinous plague that's going to destroy us all if it gets a chance to, we're all going to end up dead under the worst circumstances. So check out my sermon, sermon number 3, for continuation of this. Hail Satan! There's different quotes in the Talmud, and the Talmud basically is a huge part of the Judeo-Christian Bible, the teachings, and even a lot of the verses. But it says here, Nidrash Talpiath 225-L, Jehovah created the non-Jew in human form so that the Jew would not have to be served by beasts. The non-Jew is consequently an animal in human form and condemned to serve the Jew day and night. Now, it also goes on here, Seth JP 92:1, God has given the Jews power over the possessions and blood of all nations. Sulchan Aruch Chatsan Hamishpat 348, all property of other nations belongs to the Jewish nation, which consequently it is entitled to seize upon without any scruples. And that's the theme of the Judeo-Christian Bible, is not owning, not having any property, and not owning anything. And they've also infused this into other religions, and in the Far East, where they these people in yoga, you're supposed to not concentrate on any of the cities or the powers of your mind or anything, or use anything for personal profit. But you can see that's all in the hands of the Jews. Getting back to the Soviet Union again, when I was a little girl, some of my shirt tail relations, they were talking about there was a family that was related to us in the Ukraine, and this was during the Stalin period. And what happened was, the Jew makes it so people can't even survive, the more control that they have. And they're doing that in this country right now. There's housing shortages, all kinds of things, and it gets to the point where you just can't survive. There's a family that was on a collective farm in the Ukraine that was related, real distant relations to me. And what happened was, they didn't have the grain or the money to pay the taxes for the farm, which the Soviets demanded. And the relatives over here, unfortunately, weren't very wise. And back then, how was one to know? They sent this family in the Ukraine money to try to cover the costs so they wouldn't be arrested. Because this isn't like the United States where, well, if you can't pay something and you don't have anything, they're not going to throw you in jail. In the Soviet Union, they did. It's like they'd kill you. And of course, the letter was intercepted, and they never got the money or anything, and they were all sent to Siberia, and they died. I guess this one woman, she died. The mother, she died eating grass. And this is all. If you do your research on the famine in the Ukraine, I'm going to read to you what went on in the Ukraine. It was genocide, and it was against the kulaks. And one of the things is communism. Lilith told me that the communist system exists out there in other worlds. And the Greys are a part of it, where they work for the reptilians or something. There's no individuality, no identity, nobody matters, they're just a number, nameless, faceless, sexless, no cultural identity, no class, they're all equally treated as just total slaves. They're a number. And that's what they've been trying to do in the Western world here. And they just want everybody not to have an identity, they don't know where they came from, where they're going, or anything. And in the Ukraine, the kulaks were the middle class, and they were the farmers, and a lot of them were German, of German descent, and they were hardworking, and the communists sought to completely destroy the middle class. That's what they're trying to do here in the United States as well, and just replace it with a worker society, in which they mean like the peasants that are just kept ignorant and uneducated, unknowing, and just disposable human beings. And as I mentioned, and I'll go into this further, I've done a series of articles also about directly on newspaper quotes of what they're doing in Red China right now. Everything's made in China. They have a system over there of disposable human beings, and they work them to death. Most of these are third world people where they're not literate. A lot of them aren't literate. Of course, in China, most people are literate, I guess. But other countries like India, and around the world, they're disposable human beings, and they work them to death, and they just bury them, or whatever, they dispose of them. And that's Jewish Goldman Sachs, Jewish cartel over here. They push for that slave labor over there, and they advocate it. They work them to death. And another one is how they go into third world countries, Sub-Saharan Africa and different places, and they actually round up kids on the street, and they kidnap them, and they take their body organs from them, and they sell them. The Jews use them for organ transplants. And that's what the Jew wants. A Jewish paradise is disposable human beings. Getting back to the famine in the Ukraine, I strongly encourage people to do their own research on this on the internet. There's a lot about it. It's been coming out. The Soviet system and the Jews, they tried to suppress this knowledge for a long time. I'm going to read about it here. And it was just heinous. I don't know how many just starved to death in the Ukraine. And the kids, that you see that they didn't even have clothes. And it's cold there, very, very cold. The winters, they didn't even have clothes. They're dressed in rags, or they're just with the clothes. There's no more clothes. They're just naked. Okay, getting back to the Gulag Archipelago. Reading about the Ukraine here, and I'm also going to read an excerpt from another book. It became necessary to rid the villages also of those peasants who had merely manifested an aversion to join in the collective farms, or an absence of inclination for the collective life, which they never seen with their own eyes, about which they knew nothing, and which they suspected, we now know how well-founded their suspicions were, would mean a life of forced labor and famine under the leadership of loafers. The leadership of loafers is the Jewish ruling government. Then it was also necessary to get rid of those peasants, some of them not at all prosperous, who, because of their daring, their physical strength, their determination, their outspokenness at meetings, and their love of justice, were favorites with their fellow villagers, and by virtue of their independence, were therefore dangerous to the leadership of the collective farm. Another thing I want to interject here, Satan is known for rebelling against tyranny. Satan represents freedom and justice, and anti-slavery. The legend of Satan in their Bible, Satan rebelled against tyranny and gave knowledge to the victims. Getting back to the book again. Beyond this, in every village there were people who in one way or another had personally gotten in the way of the local activists. This was the perfect time to settle accounts with them of jealousy, envy, insult. A new word was needed for all these new victims of the class, and it was born. By this time, it had no social or economic content whatsoever, but it had a marvelous sound. Podkulachnik, a person aiding the kulaks. In other words, I consider you an accomplice of the enemy, and that finishes you. The most tattered landless laborer in the countryside could quite easily be labeled as the podkulachnik. And so it was these two terms embraced everything that constituted the essence of the village, its energy, its keenness of wit, its love of hard work, its resistance, and its conscience. They were torn up by the roots and collectivization was accomplished. Now, for those of you who don't know what collectivization is, it's a communist deal, and it's also, Israel, they have their kibbutz, which proves where they're at, where it's, and they are communists. But they play both sides. Like I said, they control both sides. And under the table, they're working with the communists like they were working with the Soviet Union, even though they pretended to hate each other. And then they allied with the United States, which the United States, they even said, is Israel's bitch. The United States fights all of Israel's wars and is big brother to enact their carry out their injustices against innocent people around the world. But collectivization is like a farm in where they all work on the same farm and nobody owns anything. So there's no ownership of property. It's just they all just work for nothing, basically. But, of course, I'm sure in Israel they get compensated, believe me. It's totally different there. But I'm talking collectivization in a communist sense. Is where you don't own your farm anymore, you don't own your animals anymore, you don't own your land anymore. The Jewish state takes control of that and has you working as a slave on your own property. That's what collectivization is about. But, okay, getting back to the book, but new waves rolled from the collectivized villages. One of them was a wave of agricultural wreckers. Everywhere they began to discover wrecker agronomists who up until that year had worked honestly all their lives but who are now purposely sowed weeds in Russian fields, on the instructions, of course, of the Moscow Institute, which had now been totally exposed. Indeed, there were those same 200,000 unarrested members of the Working Peasants Party, the TKP. Certain agronomists failed to put into effect the profound instructions of Lysenko. And in one such wave, in 1931, Lorik the so-called king of the potato, was sent to Kazakhstan. Others carried out the Lysenko directives too precisely and thus exposed their absurdity. In 1934, Peskov, agronomist, sowed flax on the snow exactly as Lysenko had ordered. The seeds swelled up, grew moldy, and died. The big fields laid empty for a year. Lysenko could not say that the snow was a kulak or that he himself was an ass. He accused the agronomists of being kulaks and distorting his technology. And the agronomists went off to Siberia. Beyond all this, in almost every machine and tractor station, wrecking in the repairing of tractors was discovered, and that is how the failures of the first collective farm were explained. There was a wave of harvest losses, losses in comparison with the arbitrary harvest figures announced the preceding spring by the Commission of Determination of the Harvest. There was a wave for failure to fulfill obligations undertaken for delivery to the state of bread grains. The district party committee had undertaken the obligation and the collective farm had not fulfilled it. Go to prison. There was a wave for snipping ears of corn. The nighttime snipping of individual ears of corn and grain in the field, a totally new type of agricultural activity, a new type of harvesting. The wave of those caught doing this was not small. It included many tens of thousands of peasants, many of them not even adults but boys, girls, and small children whose elders had sent them out at night to snip because they had no hope of receiving anything from the collective farm for their daytime labor. For this bitter and not very productive occupation, an extreme of poverty to which the peasants had not been driven even in serfdom, the courts handed out a full measure, 10 years for what ranked as an especially dangerous theft of socialist property under the notorious law of August 7, 1932, which in prisoner's lingo was simply known as the law of 7/8. This law of 7/8 produced another big separate wave from which the construction projects of the first and second five-year plans, which transport, trade, and industry. Big thefts were turned over to the NKVD. This wave must further be kept in mind as one that kept on flowing steadily for the next 15 years until 1947, especially during the war years. Then in 1947, the original law was expanded and made much more harsh. Now at last, all the mass waves are coming to an end. Comrade Molotov said on May 17, 1933, "We do not see our task as being mass repressions. But what's that dog howling out there? Go get him, go get him." And here we are. The Kirov wave from Leningrad has begun. While it lasted, the tension was acknowledged that to be so great that special staffs of the NKVD were set up in each and every district executive committee of the city and accelerated judicial procedure was introduced. Even earlier, it had not been famous for being slow, and there was no right of appeal. There had been no appeal earlier. It is also believed that one quarter of Leningrad was purged, cleaned out in 1934 to 1935. Let this estimate be disproved by those who have the exact statistics and are willing to publish them. To be sure, this wave took in much more than Leningrad alone. It had a substantial impact on the rest of the country in a form that was consistent, though chaotic. The firing from the civil service of all those still left there whose fathers had been priests, all former noble women, and all persons having relatives abroad. Among such lashing waves as this, certain modest, changeless wavelets always got lost. They were little heard of, but they too kept flowing on and on. Now here's another account from the book The Russian Century, A History of the Last 100 Years by Brian Moynihan. Okay, and this is chapter 5 of the book, and people need to know what was going on. It was written in 1994, copyright 1994, Kulag Killer. And this is what was done to the Ukraine under Stalin, and it was also an act of genocide. They wiped out most of the people in the Ukraine were of German descent. And this is one of the real reasons that Adolf Hitler invaded Russia, was to try to help these people and get German. The truth of it is history is rewritten by the Jews. But Adolf Hitler was a humanitarian, and he was trying to get the German people out of there, that they were being heavily persecuted in Russia just for being German. And they knew of accounts of what was going on. Okay, this is chapter 5, Kulag Killer, and I'm reading from this, and I suggest you do your own research. I mean, anything that I read or anything, check up on it for yourself and see what's going on, and know that that phony Holocaust that the Jews are always screaming about is a cover for all of this. Okay, it's to distract people from the truth, and this you have to do research about. You're not going to see anything like this on the YouTube television or at the movie theaters. Go now to a Russian village, and the catastrophe still casts a shadow over the place. Rusting machinery is dumped around slimy yards, weeds flourish in the fields, fence posts sag, and only splashes of color are in small private plots on the gray periphery of the collective. The people are listless and wary, the temple lethargic, the buildings unpainted and cheerless. The animals have a hangdog air. More than 60 years ago, farms and peasant holdings were collectivized. Kulags, peasants who showed vigor and enterprise, were destroyed wholesale. The countryside remains an aftershock. Alexander Solzhenitsyn described the process as an ethnic catastrophe in the communist volunteers, in which communist volunteers and OGPU agents, like raging beasts, rounded up kulags and their families and drove them, stripped of their possessions, naked into the northern tundra and the taiga. Boris Pasternak, who made a trip amass material on collectivization, found himself silenced with horror. What I saw could not be expressed in words. There was such inhuman, unimaginable misery, such a terrible disaster, that it began to seem almost abstract. It would not fit within the bounds of consciousness. The terror famine inflicted as a matter of socialist policy from the beginning of 1930 probably killed 14 million peasants. The exact figure is not known, as Khrushchev pointed out. No one was keeping count. But the death rate was so horrific that the 1937 census, suppressed with the black humor that communism managed so well, members of the census board were arrested for treasonably exerting themselves to diminish the population of the USSR. Whole villages were depopulated. An American labor organizer, Fred Beale, who had gone to Russia to avoid a possible jail sentence in the U.S., made a random visit to a village 2 hours by train from Kharkov. He found only one living person, a woman who had gone mad. In the houses, there were only corpses, he wrote. He found a note in one cabin. My son, we couldn't wait. One social class, the Kulags, was exterminated, and a new one, the Brezhpinorya, the homeless ones, grew more numerous. Orphans and abandoned children, who lived in freight cars and unfinished buildings and scavenged for cats, birds, and potato peelings. Of the dead, perhaps 4 million were children. Arthur Koestler, who found the enormous land wrapped in a blanket of silence, said that the wasted looked like embryos out of alcohol bottles. Collectivization was a social and economic disaster. Communist ideology, honed in the reading rooms of Western Europe, broke the spirit of the villages and turned the fields barren. Grain production slumped disastrously. Peasants forced to join collectives on pain of deportation to the Siberian wastes would sign up in the morning and then in the evening would slaughter their livestock, smash machines, and destroy crops rather than let the state have them. They gorged themselves on the slaughtered animals that everyone had a greasy mouth. Slaughter was protest, even if it also brought starvation. 3 years after the start of collectivization, the number of sheep and goats was reduced by two-thirds, horses by half, of cattle by nearly half. Because communism is so clearly the handiwork of intellectuals, because its ideology appears like its language so complex, because it ruled so much of the earth, it is difficult to dismiss it as, one would say, a quack medicine. But collectivization was no more than the act of simpletons and sadists. Grains consumption was less than in 1935. Grain consumption was less in 1935 after the supposed triumph of collectivization than it had been in the 1890s. Crop yields on collective farms in the early 1990s are only marginally better than in the pre-mechanization 1913. Peasants will not work willingly for the state. Monster farms are inefficient. Proof was instantly available. In 1938, the small private plots still permitted to peasants grew more than a fifth of the total Soviet produce, yet they accounted for less than 1/25th of the cultivated land. Such evidence of the lunacy and the drive to socialist agriculture was ignored. As to its effect on the party, it tipped a balance already weighted by Lenin toward humanity. And Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, was a Jew, another Jew, and a communist leader, for those of you who don't know. And any rebellion, just like with Satan, they squash it. Pace by pace, as they followed one routine directive after another, of the administrators of Bolshevik terror, they climbed down the steps from the human condition into that of beasts. Farms recovered under the new economic policy in the 1920s. In 1928, more than four-fifths of the grain was harvested by private farmers, the vast majority of them peasants with small holdings. 315 million hectares were in private ownership. If farm production had not yet reached pre-war levels, it was getting there. The Soviet Union was still massively a peasant country. More than 80% of the population lived in its 600,000 hamlets and villages. The communist attitude to country people, however, was murderous. The party never enjoyed rural affection. It was obliged to send in city volunteers when it wished to be heard, for it had no local hold on the villages. Its leaders had no insight into the peasant mass other than sensing its hostility and its blasphemous urge to own land and livestock. Lenin's brief foray as a landowner had failed. Trotsky had abandoned the family estate. Stalin had been a city agitator. Before them, Karl Marx's natural habitat had been the library. Mixed with the Bolsheviks' lethal hatred of farmers was, to be sure, the characteristic dream of eventual rural utopia. Lenin said in the future lay in vast Marxist factory farms. The peasant on these huge collectives, Stalin spoke of grain factories, of a quarter of a million acres would be indistinguishable from the factory worker. And another thing I want to interject here is Jews, how many Jewish farmers have you ever seen? They all go to the city and they hate farmers because farmers are Gentiles, peasants, Gentiles. And you don't see any Jewish farmers. They look upon that as lowly. And farmers are actually the backbone of the nation. They produce all our food that we eat, and they work for it. But the Jews want to destroy those people. So here it is. The peasants realized they were being enslaved. They referred to the VKP, the mnemonic for the All-Union Communist Party, the Second Serfdom. With collectivization, every ear of corn became socialist property, and to snip so much as one merited a 10-year sentence under a well-used law passed on the seventh day of an eighth month on August 7, 1932, and known to the thousands sent to camps under it as the Law of Seven-Eighths. Lenin's contempt for rural people had a particular quality to it. He had reveled in a famine that hit the Volga region in 1892 and railed against relief workers. Psychologically, he wrote, the talk of feeding the starving is nothing but an expression of the saccharine sweet sentimentality so characteristic of our intelligentsia. In the Civil War, he wrote with gusto of the beautiful plan by which the party, under peasant guise, would hang the kulaks and landowners. As for the peasants, they would not escape. We will pin it on them later, he wrote. The NEP had never been more than a forced concession, a breathing space, as Lenin put it, a strategic retreat that will allow us to advance on a broad front in the very near future. The revolution had seen a massive leveling down in farming. The great estates and the farms of the smaller landlords had been seized by peasants who controlled nine-tenths of plowland. The number of landless peasants halved, while that of farmers with more than 27 acres fell more. The larger farms, which had supplied the cities, disappeared. The bulk of grain was produced and consumed by smallholders. In 1928, there was little incentive for them to part with their grain. There were a few city goods for them to buy, and the state price for grain did not cover costs. Grain was hoarded or eaten on the farms. The towns were becoming hungry. Quotas were set and requisitioning squads sent out to seize grain. Peasants hid it or sold it illegally to private traders. An ideological assault was prepared. It was necessary to excite class hatred in the villages. Peasants were duly categorized, poor, middle, and kulak. The first meant fist in the Russian and had been tagged to village moneylenders before the revolution. Kulak, though in theory defining a peasant rich enough to hire the labor of others, swiftly became a catch-all, where a peasant was clearly too beggared to apply. He could neatly be dealt with as a kulak sympathizer. Molotov spoke of dealing with kulaks, such a blow that the middle peasants would snap to attention before us. By 1929, meat was also being requisitioned and rationing was introduced into towns. There was press talk of a wholesale collectivization campaign. By mid-1929, only 3% of peasants were on collective or state farms. On December 27, 1929, 6 days before celebrating his 50th birthday, in what Louis Fisher of the Nation called an orgy of personal glorification, Stalin formally unleashed a new revolution. The country's grain-producing areas were to be collectivized at once. All kulaks were to be liquidated. That means killed. "We must smash the kulaks, eliminate them as a class," he said. On January 30, 1930, the Politburo approved a resolution on measures for the elimination of kulak households in districts of comprehensive collectivization. This document has not achieved the notoriety of the final solution. See, and it's as though it yields nothing to it in terms of scale and malice. So you see that final solution. You see, the Jews are always promoting that, but you don't hear about things like this. It divided the kulaks into three categories. Those in the first were to be shot or imprisoned. The second, including families of the first, faced deportation. And the third were to be expelled from the kulaks, the collective farm, and settled on marginal marsh or forest land. In practice, those in the third category could not meet the state grain procurement for poor land, and so they were deported too. The most hostile and reactionary kulaks were to be sent to concentration camps in distant areas of the far north. The first arrests took place at the end of 1929. These were carried out by the OGPU officers and normally involved the execution of former white soldiers who had believed themselves amnestied. The white soldiers were the ones that fought against the red soldiers, the communists. Mass action began at the start of 1930. It involved hundreds of thousands of families on a scale too large for OGPU, so that party activists were drafted in from the towns. The novelist Vasil Biokov lived in a Belarusian village too poor to have any recognizable kulaks, but dekulakization was compulsory. Top secret letters sent out in February 1930 gave orientation numbers of kulaks to be deported by region. "There shall be no oscillation, no concession to rightist deviant attitudes, and no pacifism," the directive warned in socialist babblespeak. Kulaks had to be found, so one family was deported because it owned a cow and a calf, another because its mare had a foal, another because a woman relative helped with the harvest. A peasant with 8 acres was forced to clear railroad tracks of snow. On his return, he found all his property seized apart from a kettle, a saucer, and a spoon. He was then sent lumbering to the far north. In some villages, a party activist would arrive from the city, produce a pistol, and say that any peasant who refused to join the kulaks would be sent immediately to Siberia. Sometimes the policy of exciting class hatred worked. The poor peasants of the village get together in a meeting and decide, "So-and-so has 6 horses. We couldn't get along without those on the collective farm. Besides, he hired a man last year to help on the harvest." A kulak told John Scott, an American volunteer in Magnitogorsk, the vast new industrial complex. They notify the OGPU, and there you are. So-and-so gets 5 years, they confiscate his property and give it to the new collective farm. Sometimes they ship the whole family out. When they came to ship us out, my brother got a rifle and fired several shots at the OGPU officers. They fired back, my brother was killed. In forming, a Russian tradition flourished. "It was so easy to do a man in," a villager recalled. "You wrote a denunciation. You did not even have to sign it. All you had to say was that he paid people to work for him as hired hands or that he owned 3 cows. Peasants were encouraged to denounce neighbors. A 14-year-old role model, Pavlik Morozov, was found. Morozov's father was said to have secretly aided kulaks. Pavlik denounced his father in court. When he later denounced other kulaks for grain hoarding, they ambushed and murdered him in the woods. This was not the truth. The father, a poor peasant who became chairman of a village Soviet in the Urals, was convicted on Pavlik's evidence of seizing kulak property rather than handing it in to the new collective farm. But the story that he had been killed by kulaks was more convenient. And it was on that basis that the father betrayer was held up as a communist martyr with the Palace of Young Pioneers in Soviet Moscow named for him. And the thing is, they encourage children just on a whim to turn in their parents, and that's the same thing with the Judeo-Christian Bible, where the Nazarene says that he will turn family member against family member and divide members of his own household. This is in the New Testament. You can look it up on the internet. Turn brother against brother. Collectivization attracted only the poorest peasants who had no land or livestock to lose. Even so, many of those who were opposed to dekulakization. The party had to use 25,000ers, communist volunteers from the cities. They were given a two-week course and sent off to run villages and manage the new collectives. A farm revolution in the world's largest country was being supervised by factory workers with 2 weeks training, most of it in propaganda. If these city types could run a farm, the peasants asked, why should a peasant not run a factory? The brutality that these 25,000ers witnessed and inflicted was enough to break even an OGPU officer. And most of these are Jews. You just got to do the research. And I'm going to write a full deal on that one and name them where you can actually verify this. The biographer Isaac Deutscher, on a train trip from Moscow to Kharkov, met an OGPU colonel who was almost sobbing as he said, I am an old Bolshevik. I worked in the underground against the Tsar and then fought in the Civil War. Did I do all that in order that I should now surround villages with machine guns and order my men to fire indiscriminately into crowds of peasants? Oh, no, no. See, some of these were Gentiles. Okay, but the Jews, they just didn't care. A hunger-ridden waif called Katia was found wandering near a railway station in the Ukraine. She had got out of the cattle car, transporting her and many other kulak families to find water. When she returned to the line, the train had gone. Kulaks sometimes spent weeks in the cars as they rolled slowly towards their place of deportation, stacked into cattle wagons or stolpin cars, windowless prison transports. The legs of some did not touch the floor for days because they were so tightly packed that they hung suspended between each other. They were fed salt herring or dried carp, sometimes sea of atsof, anchovies, and then left for hours without water. And this is very, very similar, I'm interjecting something here, of what the Jews did to the African slaves. It's the same methods that they use. It goes all the way back to the Inquisition. It's very Jewish. Just pack them like sardines, and whether they get there or not, they're disposable human beings. It says, and thus we set out, wrote Solzhenitsyn, of his own experience in a stolpin car, and entangled in other bodies, fell asleep to the clacking of the wheels without knowing whether we will see forest or steppe tomorrow. Sometimes they could judge from a snatch of sun whether they were being taken east or north. They were en route for use as slave labor in a vast new system of camps controlled by the OGPU agency, the chief executive of corrective labor camps. Its Russian acronym was Gulag. The camps had some 30,000 inmates in 1928. By 1931, the figure was above 2 million, climbing daily as the white coal, as the OGPU guards called the kulaks, was delivered. In sheer size, this non-recurring tidal wave, it was an ocean, swelled beyond the bounds of anything the penal system of even an immense state can permit itself, said Solzhenitsyn. Nobody bothered simply with the head of the family. They burned out whole nests, whole families from the start, he noted, and they watched jealously to be sure that none of the children, 14, 10, even 6 years old, got away to the last scrapings. All had to go down the same road to the same common destruction. Children could not escape their origins. It was written on their IDs, opening them to a whole world of discrimination in which they were ineligible for rations, for clothing vouchers, for education. Some kulaks toiled in the White Sea, Baltic Sea Canal, hacking at rocks with hammers and chisels, carting the spoil on their backs. Half-clad, they faced the winter in flimsy barracks. Perhaps 100,000 died. Stalin cruised through their handiwork on its completion, his 160-foot portrait decorating its banks. Too shallow for the naval vessels which it was designed, it was soon idle and unrepaired. Stalin had a passion for gold as well as canals. And I want to interject something here, too, about Jews and gold. It's very obvious. I mean, they deal in gold and diamonds. And just like you have Goldberg, Goldstein, Gould. Many of their names have gold prefixes on them because Jews are synonymous. They hoard gold. getting back to the book, he read Bret Hart, Sutter's Gold, and other books on the California Gold Rush. A fresh OGPU agency, Dalstroy, was set up with a headquarters at Madigan to develop gold mining by forced labor in Kolyma in northeast Siberia, one of the coldest regions on Earth. Entire camps perished, including guards and their dogs. In a camp on the Yenisei River, kulaks lived in dugouts. At camp number 205 in the Siberian taiga north of Severno, they worked in the mine on rations of a pint of soup and 5 ounces of bread a day. And I said they worked brutally hard labor. Most of them starved to death. 2 million kulaks were dumped in special settlements on the 400-mile stretch between Grayanovets and Archangel. Strings of carts rolled through the villages, flanked by convoy troops vanishing into the snowy steppe. At Yemetsk, there was a vast camp of families that had become separated from their fathers. 32,000 lived in 97 barracks with no medical care. In Kazakhstan, kulaks found pegs stuck in the raw ground with little notices saying settlement number 5, number 6, and so on. They dug themselves holes in the ground. A great many died of cold and hunger. Anything between a quarter and a third of the deportees died, many of them children. A saying was that Moscow does not believe in tears. Any sadism would be visited on the kulak for his class essence, rendered him a subhuman to be eliminated en masse. You do not lament the loss of hair of one who has been beheaded, said Stalin. The party claimed in the spring of 1930 that half of all peasant households had been collectivized. The effects were ruinous. A quarter of the cattle, sheep, and goats, and a third of the pigs of the Soviet Union were slaughtered in 1930. The great bulk of them were killed and eaten in February and March by peasants who were determined that they should not be given in to the collectives. The most productive peasants were herded off as kulaks. The wastrels and idlers who denounced them flourished. The surviving middle peasants, cowed and sullen, were in no mood to exert themselves for the state. Total collapse threatened at the start of the spring sowing season. On the 2nd of March, 1930, Stalin wrote an article in Pravda under the headline, Dizzy with Success. Collectivization was a stunning success. Stalin lied, but some local officials were going too fast. The pace should be slowed. Almost half of the new collective farms collapsed in March and April. Millions of peasants went back to working for themselves, but they did not escape for long. Once the harvest was gathered, the campaign started. Stalin ended the drive in a secret circular in the spring of 1933. The victory of the collective farm system was now won, he said, which makes it possible, as a rule, to stop the use of mass deportations and sharp forms of repression in the countryside. By that time, two-thirds of peasants had been subjected to the second serfdom, and the grain-growing areas, 90%, had been stripped of ownership and toiled on collectives. And one of the reasons for that is they had no more people to work in the collective farms. They're killing them all. And this is no different if you see the movie, HBO movie about Stalin. He killed so many of his generals. I mean, the mass murder, it just went on and on. During the Second World War, when it started out, he didn't have any generals left. I mean, they were all dead. He was just crazy. I mean, the guy was psychotic. But when he started killing Jews in the doctor's plot in 1953, then he died. But anyway, getting back to this, special treatment was meted out to regions with Stalin suspected of nourishing nationalism. Worse among them was the Ukraine, which suffered a terrible ordeal by deportation and starvation. Warning of his malice was given in a series of show trials in the Kharkov Opera House, in which a string of scholars and lawyers confessed, after torture to membership of an underground nationalist movement. And these were tortured, forced confessions. The plot had been extended to the villages by 1932. Collectivization and resistance to it were particularly strong in the Ukraine. By the middle of the year, almost three-quarters of Ukrainian peasants had been forced into collectives far above the norm in Russia. The Ukrainian kolkhoz was bigger and more brutally managed. So was grain requisitioning. In 1931, 7.7 million tons of grain was demanded by the state from a Ukrainian harvest, which collectivization had brought down to 18 million tons. This left the peasants on a near starvation rations. In July 1932, Stalin served a death sentence. He again ordered 7.7 million tons to be delivered to the state. By now, the ravages of collectivization had reduced the harvest to a mere 14.7 million tons. The demand, even then, when eventually reduced to 6.6 million tons, condemned millions to death by starvation. Requisitioning gangs of communist activists, armed with steel rods up to 10 feet long, swarmed over the Ukraine. They searched in the house, in the attic, the shed and the cellar, a victim recalled. Then they went outside and searched in the barn, pig pen, granary, and straw pile. Crude watchtowers were put up in the fields, posts with a hut of wood and straw atop them. Here the guards, armed with shotguns, would look out for snippers, those who were driven by hunger to cut off ears of corn with scissors. Those who were caught got a minimum of 10 years under the law of Seventh-day Son were shot. One Kharkov court issued 1,500 death sentences in a month. A woman was given a 10-year sentence for cutting 100 ears of corn from her plot 2 weeks after her husband died of starvation. The remaining chickens and pigs were eaten in the early winter of 1932. Then the dogs and cats went. It was hard to catch them, wrote Vasily Groshman. The animals had become afraid of people and their eyes were wild. People boiled them but were left with tough veins and muscles, and from their heads they made a meat jelly. Only 4.7 million tons of grain had been delivered by the end of 1932. A new levy was announced. A further 17,000 activists were drafted into the political departments of the machine tractor stations and 8,000 into farm political departments. They made no difference. There was nothing left to take. Scapegoats, agricultural records had to be found to explain the shortfall. Meteorologists were arrested for issuing false weather forecasts to damage the harvest. Veterinarians were shot for sabotaging livestock. Agronomists were accused of being kulaks and deported to Siberia. In almost every MTS wrecking, and the repairing of tractors was discovered, wrote Solzhenitsyn. And that is how the failures of the first collective farm years were explained. Mass starvation started when the snow melted in March of 1933. People ate rats, ants, and earthworms. They made soup with dandelions and nettles. The New York Evening Journal correspondent visited a village 20 miles from Kiev. In one hut they were cooking a mess that defied analysis, he wrote. There were bones, pigweed skin, and what looked like a boot top in the pot. Cannibalism came. Children and strangers were ambushed and eaten. There were people who cut up and cooked corpses and killed their own children and ate them. She had been brought to the district center under convoy. Her face was human, but her eyes were those of a wolf. Some were shot, but 325 Ukrainian cannibals labored on canal projects. The famous blind bards of the Ukraine, who kept alive old national ballads, were less useful than cannibals. They made poor slave laborers, so they were asked to a special congress and shot, along with filmmakers, artists, and newspapermen. People abandoned their villages. They squatted along rail tracks, begging for crusts to be thrown from carriage windows and inundated railroad stations. They followed troops on maneuvers. They crawled about on all fours in towns. Carts went through the streets of Kiev each morning, collecting the corpses of those who had died in the night. The children had thin, elongated faces like dead birds. Some of them were still muttering. I asked the driver about them, and he just waved his hands and said, by the time they get where they are being taken, they will be silent too. In Kirovograd, children were herded into an open encampment from which people heard frightening, inhuman cries. Still the activists searched for grain, shot mothers whom they found digging up potatoes, beat those who were not swollen up, and the telltale sign of starvation to make them reveal their source of food. We were realizing historical necessity, wrote the activist Lev Kopolev. We were performing our revolutionary duty. We are obtaining grain for the socialist fatherland. That's a Jew, by the way. And they try to say it was necessary and all this stuff. It's just horrible. I've heard all kinds of crap out of those people, making excuses for communism the same way they make excuses for Christianity. Okay, this goes. I saw women and children with distended bellies, turning blue, with vacant, lifeless eyes, and corpses. Corpses in ragged sheepskin coats and cheap felt boots, corpses in peasant huts, in the melting snow of the old Volgograd, and under the bridges of Kharkov. I saw all this and did not go out of my mind or commit suicide. I believed because I wanted to believe. The starvation was politically induced. There was food in the Ukraine, the old breadbasket of the Tsarist Empire. It was piled, rotting, and smoking from spontaneous combustion in dumps guarded by the OGPU machine gunners. It was stacked on groaning side tables and canteens for party officials. It was available for hard currency or precious metals in Torskin stores so that Roman Catholics in the Zhytomyr province, who buried their dead with gold rings, now dug up the graves at night and survived. It was exported to earn currency for industrialization drive. And they're always trying to inject in these books about the Christians and stuff. That's what I'm talking about, and that's the only way a lot of these people get published, and it's true. Anything done to the Christians, like Christian leaders or Jews, they just scream and whine about it. Anyway, it says almost 2 million tons of grain were exported in 1932, and Hungary, 1.7 million tons were sold on international markets at knockdown depression prices. The savagery is not restricted to the Ukraine, where Robert Conquest, in the classic account of collectivization, Harvest of Sorrow, estimates that 5 million people died, between a fifth and a quarter of the Ukrainian rural population. Perhaps a quarter of the Kazakh people died during collectivization. The Germans of the Lower Volga, who had been encouraged to immigrate by Catherine the Great, lost perhaps 200,000 of their number to hunger and the Gulag. Cossack regions from the Don and Kuban suffered grievously through the deportation and hunger. And by the way, the Russian Cossacks, they've always been known for hating Jews. The Jewish ritual murder and stuff, the Cossacks used to really enact justice, and they'd wipe entire villages out and known what as pogroms of Jews that were murdering their children and creating terror in the pre-Soviet days. It says a stanitsa, or village, that had supported 20,000 was reduced to a naked man fighting with cats in the dust over a dead pigeon. The remainder had been deported or killed in one of the many revolts that marked collectivization. Red Army morale slumped, for in every unit there was a mass desertion of peasant soldiers who hastened to their native villages with or without their rifles to wreak vengeance on the executives of the collectives. In parts of the Ukraine and the North Caucasus, aircraft were used to put them down. A squadron which refused to machine gun Cossack villages was disbanded and half its personnel executed. It was an offense punishable at best by 3 to 5 years in a labor camp to refer to the famine. A doctor who complained that his sister had died of hunger was sentenced to 10 years without the right of correspondence, the euphemism for a death sentence. The newspapers in the Ukraine, Arthur Kersler found, were full of pictures of smiling children while skeletons tottered in the streets. Word of the famine reached the West through diplomatic reports and foreign correspondence, notably Malcolm Muggeridge of Manchester Guardian, W.H. Chamberlain of the Christian Science Monitor, and the New York Herald Tribune. An international relief committee was set up under the Archbishop of Vienna. It could do nothing, however, for the Soviet government denied that any famine was taking place. The lie was reinforced by Western fellow travelers. George Bernard Shaw, the famous playwright, visited the Soviet Union in 1932. I did not see a single undernourished person in Russia, young or old, he said after his chauffeur-driven tour. Were they padded? Were their hollow cheeks distended by pieces of India rubber inside? Visiting in 1932 and 33, they approved of driving out the universally hated kulaks. The government, they said, could hardly have acted otherwise than it did. If it had been a partial failure of crops, this was made worse by individual peasants who, out of spite, sabotaged the field grains, even cutting off a whole year or carrying it off for individual hoarding. When a visit was made by Edward Harriet, twice French Prime Minister, shop windows in Kiev were filled with food and starving orphans were cleared off the streets. The distinguished radical was taken to the October Revolution collective farm near Kiev. The buildings had been decorated with furniture from a local theater and carpets and tablecloths trucked in from Kiev. The peasants were fed hunks of meat washed down with beer. Harriet returned to France to say that a clear conscience that he had seen no hunger in the Soviet Union. So you see how they try to cover it up. And in a third book that I have here, and again, this is getting way too long, but people need to know and get educated, it reveals how the Soviets would not allow the Ukrainians to even mention the famine. Okay, and finishing up here, just as the Jews, communism is a Jewish program, they're prolific liars. And they tried to, for years, under the Soviet regime, which Ukraine was part of, they're subjugated, you know, they didn't even know, the younger generations, about the horrific famine that took place there in the early 30s. The Soviet government tried to, pawn it off as artificial famine. I'm just going to read a short excerpt here, a paragraph, and I'm going to close this because it's already gotten too long, but this is very serious. This is what they're trying to do in the United States here, and this is no joke. Most people aren't even aware of it. This book is called The Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union by David Satter. And it says here, after the Ukrainian wave, the national movement turned its attention to the artificial famines of the 1930s, and the next important event in Ukraine's drive towards independence was the commemoration of the genocide in September 1990 in Targan, a village near Kiev. By early 1990, the full psychological impact of Glasnost was being felt. Mine shafts filled with the bodies of Stalin's victims were being excavated all over the country. It seemed that every day new skeletons were being exhumed and candles were being lit. Most disturbingly for Ukrainians, however, was the testimony that was published in the newspapers about the artificial famines directed against the peasantry during the 1930s, particularly the famine of 1933. For years it had been common to regard the boundaries between Soviet republics as unimportant. But Ukrainians now learned that during the 1930s, the boundary between Russia and Ukraine had been the demarcation between life and death, because the Soviet authorities did not inflict an artificial famine on Russia. People in all parts of the republic were forced to think about the difference between Soviet and Ukrainian identity. The Ukrainian language, long confined to the western Ukraine and the countryside, began to be more widely spoken, and Ukrainian scholars, for decades, prevented from writing about their history honestly, started to describe Ukrainian history as a litany of Soviet and Russian crimes. The rising national consciousness, the desire to know the past, became for many people an obsession, and it led thousands of Ukrainians to converge on Targan. On the 7th of September 1990, as the setting sun bathed the Targan cemetery in its slanting light, Alexandra Avdijnuk held the hand of her friend Osila Maso and cried freely. She could hardly believe that after so many years the world was remembering what had happened in this remote place. Volodymyr Mayenyak, a Ukrainian historian, ascended the stairs of a wooden platform that had been erected over three elevated burial mounds, beneath which were the bones of 360 people who died of starvation in 1933. Nearby was a statue of a little girl bearing a cross. On the statue was written, "Through starvation and brutal work, they were deprived of life." Avdijuk waited for Manyak to begin. How, she wondered, could mere words describe what had happened here? On a gray November morning in 1987, Avdijuk walked out to the mailbox for her copy of Selsky Vesti, the Ukrainian agricultural paper. She took the paper back to her small wooden house, sat down next to the coal stove, unfolded it, and received a shock. In a front-page article, the newspaper gave a detailed description of the 1933 famine. Ever since the beginning of the new policy of Glasnost, the newspapers had been getting freer. But Avdijuk had not expected anything like this. She ran out of the house to the home of her friend, Olisa Maslow, who had also survived the famine. "Have you read the newspaper?" Avdijuk asked. "I saw it. For more than 50 years, the two women had talked about the famine only among themselves." Avdijuk had taught history in the village school, praising the achievements of socialism. She had not breathed a word to her students about the famine, but she and Maslow had long vowed that they would one day collect the names of the residents of Targan who died of starvation. "Well, are you ready?" Avdijuk asked. "I'm ready. What if they arrest us? I'm not afraid." It had been a lifetime ago, yet to Avdijuk it seemed only yesterday. Okay, I'm going to stop reading there. I know I've read long enough. People need to know about what happened in the Ukraine and also in Russia. They didn't have necessarily famine all over the place. There were places. I'm going to get to that and how people were just brutally arrested left and right. And they're planning on doing this here in the United States, because if the United States goes, every single so-called free country is going to go with it. The smaller ones will just collapse. And that's what they're trying, working overtime. And all of this is laid down in the Bible. And as I said, the Bible, just about every home has a Bible in it. Hotels, hospitals, the Bible's pushed on everybody. It is a book of Jewish witchcraft. And years ago, I still have not come up with a technical name for this, but I read a book about how subliminally certain people were able to put their hands on a book and in a certain way and absorb all the knowledge within it. This Bible, the Bible, what it does, it creates a subliminal link, and they carry things out that way. I've written a lot about it, about the Bible, the Jewish Book of Communism, and it's all in the Satan's Library, ExposingChristianity.com, and I'm going to have to end this now. And again, Satan rebelled against tyranny. Satan rebelled against slavery, and that's why he's condemned and damned in the Bible. And the Bible is nothing spiritual. It is a Jewish book to enslave the world. And all the foundations of communism are in the Bible, and Christianity is a preparation, preparing people to be enslaved by communism. And I'm going to end this now. It's been long enough, but people need to know. Get the word out. Learn about communism. Learn the truth about it. The Jews say one thing. They try to pass it off just like Christianity. Oh, it's going to help you. All this, and it's nothing but lies. If you look beneath the surface of it, it's horrific. And I'll be bringing some more references in my next sermon. Hail Satan!